Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You know, earlier this month, the White House hosted a celebration of music. It was from the Civil Rights Movement. Bob Dylan performed a song, "The Times They Are Changing." But I guess the question today is, are they, or is it too soon to tell? Today we're going to talk about how the election of President Barack Obama had its roots in the Civil Rights era and how that era differs from today, perhaps. We'll take a look at the presidency 1 year later and maybe what the election of the first black president means for the future of the Civil Rights Movement as well in the lives of ordinary African Americans. Joining us is University of Florida history professor Paul Ortiz. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on.
And also Miami University history professor Nishani Frazier. Nishani, thanks for being with us today.
Sure. Good morning.
And in the studio, so I'm not all alone, is Andrew Grant Thomas. He is the deputy director of the Kerwin Institute for Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Good to be here, Ann.
I guess the first question is the qualifying question. Can we draw many conclusions about Barack Obama's presidency after just a year? Paul?
Well, I think this is a question that we're all asking, isn't it? And certainly in the South, it's a question that really is on everyone's minds. I mean, I was at a meeting the other day with a group of African-American trade unionists, and the emphasis was on economic issues. And the message was, we really need to push President Obama on some of these major issues, unionization, the need to deal with health care, unemployment, so on and so forth. So from kind of a perspective of African-American organizers or community activists in the South, and I think others as well, it's too soon. But when we say too soon, in part what we're saying is that it's not just simply judgment about President Obama. It's also a kind of analysis of what those who supported him are up to right now. And and many of these activists are, you mentioned earlier, the civil rights movement, and people who were in the movement in the 50s and 60s and who passed down those lessons tend to take a very long-term view of politics. And so I think they have not lost patience, but at the same time, there is a sense of urgency.
And I'd sort of add on to what Paul is saying about sort of the attitude of civil rights activists, that in addition to sort of can we judge, I think what we can judge on is the degree to which activism needs to take place on the local level. That if there's going to be movement on the part of the government, if there's going to be any movement on the part of the Obama administration, that has to come from the bottom up. And what we also can draw a conclusion on is that he's already going to have difficulty getting half of what he wants to get done through the Congress. All right.
Difficulty is a nice light word.
Which is why it's so important to have that kind of local activism, because Congress needs that pressure coming from their own individual communities to push them in the direction that sort of activists are wanting them to go. So I think that's definitely, you know, something we can consider right now.
You know, I sensed a lot more of that local activism at the outset of his presidency, and it was very overt, and I haven't sensed it much since.
I agree with that, and I think part of that has to do with sort of the energy of the moment, that, you know, we are geared toward this one sort of individual act, the election of Barack Obama, right? Once we get to that, then apparently it's supposed to be in Barack Obama's hands, right? And so I think part of the problem is that they didn't articulate a sort of a long-term plan of what this activism, grassroots activism, was going to look like, right? Mm-hmm. That it stretched beyond the election of Barack Obama to what are the ideas and plans that we have for American society, and then how do we intend to get that up off the ground?
Andrew?
First of all, I'd like to agree with something that both Paul and Nishani have brought up, which is that he will need to be pushed. I mean, I think that's one thing that we're getting here, and that push is going to have to come from bottom up. In one respect, it's somewhat unfair, both with respect to the situation of African Americans and what President Obama can do about it, and with respect to the situation of the country, to after a year judge him or at least have a firm judgment about his performance. You know, he's been in office 400 days. African-Americans have been here 400 years. And, of course, he inherited
nice
a lot
little,
of –
nice little parallel there.
Thank you very much. and of course, he inherited, you know, a huge mess. On the other hand, while the long view is important to take, at the same time, we have to appreciate that, you know, there's some – something inherent in the crisis of the moment, especially economic, that means that opportunities will be lost if they're not taken now, or at least if they're not taken now. So with respect to health care, for example, or the nature of the recovery will be much more difficult it'll be much more difficult to make progress later if we don't make the right kind of moves right now.
Is the moment over for this term? I mean, has all that is that energy passed now, or is there still possibilities?
I think there are still possibilities. I mean, I think Andrew and Ashani are exactly correct. I mean, I think it's important to take both a long-term view, but also understanding that we're in the midst of the biggest economic crisis we face since the Great Depression. I mean, the long-term view is my wife and I traveled to Trinidad this summer to do research, and everywhere we went, people were talking. They wanted to talk to us about President Obama. There were about 20 Obama T-shirts for every one Bob Marley T-shirt. And, you know, people – and but the one thing that people told us, and it was interesting, is they said, you know, you guys have to remember in the United States that Barack Obama cannot overturn many, many years of malfeasance right away, that your country has been on the wrong course for quite a long time. I mean, this is what people were telling us. We were just kind of listening. And that it's going to take him a long time. But at the same time, there is really a sense of urgency. And I think, you know, traveling through many parts of the South, the Mississippi Delta and Georgia, and certainly in Florida, which is in a huge economic crisis, I mean, that's what we're experiencing here. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're tending to take perhaps kind of a short-term view at this moment. It's like, what can the president do to bail us out? Because we are in dire straits. Mm-hmm. Unemployment in Florida is, the latest stat I saw, was about 14%. Mm-hmm. And we've had years of an economic model, which is essentially premised on low wages, tourism, unlimited development, and we've reached the end of the line. Now, that model was not Barack Obama's fault. That was a model that was developed here shortly after World War II. But currently, we're just kind of grasping for something new. And I think that's part of the sense of urgency.
And then there's also sort of what is being presented to the public. And this is also something that he's having to deal with. That, for example, when there are bailouts available, they're available to the big companies, to the banks. All right. There's this feeling that the little man, that the middle class is not being included. There's this new survey that has come out among all the many surveys that continue to come out about the public's attitude toward Congress, and that nobody is happy with congressmen, but then they continue to reelect them into the positions 90% of the time. Yes, there's certainly sort of that space for, you know, for change that needs to take place, but that people are feeling that the government could be acting in ways to move forward toward that better economic status, social positioning, but has not moved in that direction.
Andrew?
You know, has the moment passed? No, the moment hasn't passed, but he's unfortunately, the administration, I think, has squandered some energy. So from, you know, his own personal approval rating, it's gone from, you know, roughly 80% or so, which, of course, is, you know, more or less typical of new presidents, down to about 50% right now. The Senate Democrats, of course, have lost their 60, that magical 60 number. And the midterm elections, you know, don't look so great for them right now. On the other hand, you know, he does have the bully pulpit. I think what he needs to do – so has he lost – he has the bully pulpit. He has an overwhelming majority still in both House and Senate. He needs, I think, to be a bit bolder. That's what I'd like to see about his leadership. I saw a – I read a finding the other day about how he actually has a historically high proportion of bills – and votes in Congress, right, that where he's made his position known have gone his way. That, to me, suggests that he's not putting himself out on the line enough, right? He is, to some degree, picking and choosing the – he's playing it safe, and he needs to play it less safe. He really needs to lead.
If you're just joining us, my guest, Andrew Grant Thomas, Deputy Director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, and also Paul Ortiz. He's a University of Florida history professor, and Nishani Frazier, a history professor at Miami University. I think Paul or Nishani, it might – you all sound alike on the phone, but I'm just kidding. One of you brought up the age difference, and it was interesting. In preparing for this, I noticed the difference. I guess folks thought that – a lot of people thought that maybe older African-Americans would be less patient, but it's – and that younger African-Americans would be more patient with his administration. Paul, maybe you said it, that – that actually anyone who was involved and lived through the civil rights movement of the 1960s knows the score a little bit better.
Well, I think it's – you know, we wouldn't want to overgeneralize, Anne, but I think when we were – last year I took a group of students to the Mississippi Delta, and we were doing oral history interviews with civil rights activists, and we met with people like John Lewis and Charles McLaurin and Margaret Block, and these were people who had – founded the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960. And I think they, you know, there was a very strong organizing sense, and this is something that really harkens back to what Nishani and Andrew have been saying, which is that if Obama is not doing what we want him to do, if the government is not doing what we want the government to do, then it's up to us to organize, to do something, and it's way beyond the notion of making our voices heard, because I think that idea of making our voices heard, I mean, in the civil rights movement, people actually organized large numbers of people and got them together and marched and had freedom schools and did things concretely beyond just, you know, calling in to the White House, although that's certainly important. But I think it's kind of a mixed bag. I wouldn't want to make generalizations as far as age. I think that people of my age demographic, for example, I mean, you have to remember that, I mean, many of us came of age at a time when all you heard about the government was government is the problem. We need to get government off our backs. And I graduated high school in 1982, and that was the constant mantra that I heard both from Republicans as well as Democrats. And so we've been kind of stuck in that gear, the low gear, if you will, of political change, because when that is your idea, your ideology of government, that is always the problem, and then all of a sudden when you realize you can't get out of that ditch without the government doing something, there's going to be a learning curve. There's going to be a learning process, and I think we're having to relearn some of those basic lessons that people like Fannie Lou Hamer and John Lewis learned and taught in the 1960s, which is that it's more than just approval ratings. And I think the approval ratings are far overblown. I mean, certainly Franklin Roosevelt, as popular as he was, at times had lower approval ratings than what Barack Obama has now. I think what we hear from community organizers, especially in the South, is organize if you want to change things. I mean, the other thing is that people understand that politics increasingly is run by money. And the bailouts, I think we talked about this earlier. Mm-hmm. When you talk to African Americans and Latinos, Asian Americans, working class whites, I mean, and these are the constituencies that elected Barack Obama. White folks who are trade unionists voted for him. I think the plurality, excuse me, was about 70%. When you talk to those folks, they all understand what runs American politics, and they understand the power of corporations, the power of Wall Street. And to counter that, however, takes a lot of mobilization, and that mobilization is what's not happening.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick Nishani, we're going to take a quick break. I want to come back to this definitely. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
To understand Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, the so-called pants bomber, British expert Douglas Murray says, start at London University.
people who are jihadi preachers and indeed members of terrorist organizations tour UK campuses and preach violence with impunity.
I'm Neil Conan, Going Radical, an NPR News investigation into the Christmas Day bomber. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation comes up today at 2 here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Light rain and a high around 37 right now. Showers likely to taper off before the afternoon with a high near 41 today. Tomorrow, a chance of snow showers mainly in the afternoon. Cloudy with a high near 35. And Wednesday, snow showers likely mainly in the afternoon again with a high near 35. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Nishani Frazier, a history professor at Miami University, also Paul Ortiz, a history professor at the University of Florida, and Andrew Grant Thomas, deputy director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. We're talking about the Obama presidency a year later. Is it too soon to tell? Because it doesn't matter. We're talking about it anyway. Nishani, you had something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I just actually wanted to tag on to what Paul was saying, and he was noting, you know, that for a lot of folks, the degree to which they think movement takes place in government mm-hmm. has to do with money, and I think that's the power of the civil rights movement, and the fact that the individual self, the belief in the individual self to affect change, right? This is sort of the lesson that you learn. You speak to any of these civil rights activists before they even connected with each other, there was an individual sense of self, right, an individual sense of social justice that allowed them to challenge the space where they were, right then and right there. If you look at my father, for example, he's a civil rights activist in Mississippi. When they passed the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision, he was the only person, only student in his school to wear a black armband to symbolize his support of that decision. All right. He moved on from that moment where he was, of course, suspended to join the civil rights movement. All right. So this notion that sort of money is a sort of all powerful entity, I think, is sort of problematic and hinders our ability to understand the power of the people.
Oh, the individual.
And the individual mm-hmm. in affecting change. And I think that's really important sort of to understand about what the civil rights movement brings.
Andrew, did you?
Well, yes, I'd like to make 2 points. One is that, you know, if we're really to assess Obama's performance and Obama's impact on, let's say, the well-being of African Americans or the sort of the mood of the country as a whole, perhaps especially on race, while the nitty-gritty of organizing and programs and policies are really important, and that's really what we've been talking about so far, There's a lot more that we could be talking about. I just want to at least flag that. So, for example, there's been a fair bit of talk already about the extent to which Obama is a role model for African Americans, right? We could also be talking about whether or not he is a role model for people who are not African American, right? Is he going to have an impact on the way non-African Americans think about African Americans and what they're capable of and who they are fundamentally as people? I mentioned the bully pulpit earlier, and the fact that Obama has an opportunity, which for the most part he hasn't taken very very deliberately, I think, to talk about race and the way that race continues to operate in this country. And yet another piece, and I'll stop there, is, you know, what does his example mean about how people understand the structure of opportunity in this country, right? So I think of Bill Bennett, the former education secretary, who, when Obama won, said, well, that's it. No more excuses.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as if the success of one extraordinary individual told us all there was to know about the way our institutions and our systems work. So there's a lot more that I think would go into a full assessment of Obama's impact beyond the policies and programs, as important as those are.
Go ahead, Nishani.
No, I was going to say I wanted to sort of jump in. I absolutely agree with that, particularly this notion of sort of post-racial sort of period after Obama, where In effect, we all get to throw our hands up in the air and say, oh, racism is over. We have elected a black president. Woo-hoo. Aren't we good? and in effect, it doesn't deal with sort of the masses of community, black, Latino, who are affected by, you know, being on the lower economic strata, the prison industrial complex. So absolutely, there is sort of a question of what is, you know, Obama's effect, not just in a political sense, but in a broad social sense. But I think that broad social sense is hindered by his unwillingness, inability, however you want to couch it, to deal with issues like race or uncomfortability, if you will, to deal with issues like race and how it affects us in society. It,
you know, arguably the speech he made about race from, was it Pittsburgh or Philadelphia?
Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Was a turning point in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
It resonated with people way beyond, you know, that even maybe even knew what the conflict was in the first place.
I think that's exactly right. It was a brilliant speech. It was an excellent speech. Unfortunately, it was a reactive speech, right? It was a mm-hmm. speech that he was compelled to make. And unfortunately, again, I think for the most part, that has been sort of the pattern and practice of his response to race since then as well. So, you know, and you know, it's not as if he has no basis, right, for fearing engaging race explicitly. In the recent State of the Union address, he didn't mention race at all, even as he mentioned, you know, all sorts of groups that deserve special concern because they've been especially hard hit by the recession, et cetera. He didn't make any reference to race, even though African Americans, Latinos, as well as women, immigrants, have been devastated even more than the country as a whole by this recession. I just want to make one other point, which is, and it speaks to what both Nishani and Paul have said about, you know, the need to have a bottom-up movement. It's certainly a much broader movement that Obama is just one critical element of what of you know, sort of the movers that need to move to make things happen, which is, you know, when you look at the nature of our challenges, certainly around along race lines or with respect to race and with respect to African Americans in particular, there's no way that one person or one administration, no matter how powerful, could do it by himself or itself. So I'll mention just one example. Place, right? The way that opportunity is structured into where people live and the fact that we still have tremendous amounts of segregation, certainly African Americans in particular, continue in many of our large metro areas to be enormously segregated from others and, more importantly than the race issue per se, from opportunity, right? Educational opportunity, jobs, housing, you know, recreational facilities, you know, clean, safe spaces. There's a limit to what Obama, he has a critical role to play. He could be a catalyst, or the administration could, but there's a limit to what he and the administration itself can do, given how long it's taken to get to where we are.
I think also his presence can sometimes act to hide some of the activism that actually is taking place on the ground level. I mean, one of the major issues in the black community emerging again is the resegregation of schools.
Exactly.
And you do see black parents who are becoming active on this issue. In the case of Durham, for example, parents were arrested at the Board of Education over the issue of what they believe to be sort of inadequate you know, training, education of their children. You also had that in Chicago where there was a minister who attempted to boycott the schools in Chicago and send some of the children sort of in the urban areas into places that would be considered sort of the upper level, better educated spaces, suburbs, that type of thing. So in a sense, there is that activism that is beginning to take place. Right. But the assumption is that that activism has to be in tandem or has been in tandem with the individual, the major leader, that person being Barack Obama. In effect, there are some other things that are going on. I think it's important to note and sort of shed light on efforts, right, to push American society in greater, better spaces.
Paul, you write that Obama has access to the bridge to bring us together. Is that like a rope bridge over unraveling over a gaping canyon, or is it kind of like a nice brand new steel bridge, or is it like that slippery wood one in the bike path near my house?
It could be a combination of all of those. And I think that, yeah, you know, Hassan Jeffries recently wrote a piece. It's a wonderful piece, and it's titled, "It's Time for Obama to End Don't Ask, Don't Talk Policy on Racism." And it appeared on the Huffington Post. And what he said was what a lot of African-Americans and people of color have been saying, certainly in the South, is that if Obama comes out and talks publicly about racism, and this is just paraphrasing what Hassan Jeffries is saying, our great fear is that racism will scare the diversity out of white folk. And I think that that's very true, especially in a state like Florida, which is traditionally and will be in the midterms in the next presidential election a battleground state. And there's a sense that if you talk too much about racism or you talk at all about racism, then you begin to lose a lot of allies. And this is not just kind of a general nebulous thing. This is what a lot of African Americans in Florida say among themselves and to each other. And the problem, though, is that so much of the crisis that we're talking about now, so much of the social problems from education to the economy to healthcare, is racialized. I mean, the problems in part have racial roots. The fact that the U.S. does not have a national healthcare system, mm-hmm. the fact that our housing market is so inequitable, the patterns of segregation that Andrew referred to earlier, these all have elements of racism within them. And so if you don't address race, then I don't understand how you can solve any of those
and
problems.
And I wonder if I can piggyback on that very quickly. I mean, Paul, I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, there is an answer. So there's no question that race in the United States and talking about it, you know, can be a minefield. There's no question about that. And there's no question that President Obama recognizes that. So it can be done badly. And that's, you know, represents real political danger for him. However, you know, as Anne noted, for example, there was a Philadelphia speech where, you know, where he came to it late, but he came and he brought an incredibly strong game, offered a very, very good speech, and made a huge recovery in the polls as a result of that. So clearly it is possible, at least, to talk. You have to be smart, but it is possible. And let me just say mm-hmm. one last thing, and I just want to distinguish between talking about race and what you say in particular, and then the question of what you do. Right. And the degree to which your policies and practices recognize the implication of race in all of those issues you mentioned, Paul, and in many more that we could name, and the need to pay attention to the particular ways in which people are situated, in which race is a part of that, such that, you know, to think that you can simply do, quote unquote, universal policies and do sort of one size fits all solutions and benefit all Americans equally, you know, that's just a mistake. And so if he doesn't do that, we're going to be in trouble.
That's true, but I think that's a question of pressure. I mean, the sort of whole issue of even talking about sort of race, or as Hassan says, scaring the diversity out of white people, is this whole question of always the ever-present backlash that can occur. And in a sense, the question out there really is Barack Obama sort of the person who is responsible for doing that? Or is it the Congressional Black Caucus? Or is it sort of the black community? In other words, one has to begin to wield power as a constituency. You have to assume that, like any other party, if they want your votes, then they're going to have to behave and give to your community all those things that your community needs. And these are the way, and this, in fact, is the way in which politics operates. So I, as much as I sort of agree with this sort of idea that Barack Obama does have to take some time at or some point begin to insert issues of race, I think more importantly, I think the community, the black community, has got to push him into those positions. That's in effect what happened with the Philadelphia speech. He was pushed into that position.
And Shani, I just want to say very quickly, I completely agree with you. There's no question about the role, again, as you said from the beginning, of bottom-up pressure and of community pressure and organizing pressure in Obama. But I don't want to let him off the hook by saying that because his position is difficult and because the difficulty of a black president talking about race is real, that it cannot be done and doesn't need to be done.
Let's take a phone call. 614-292-8513. Don, you kind of want to talk about this. That's why I wanted to get you on the air.
Yeah, you kind of answered my question. The speakers in the last few minutes kind of answered basically what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to say that I agree with both of the last two speakers about President Obama being in a very difficult place, because if he addresses racism, he will alienate a lot of people. And I think some of the backlash that we see even now with some of the right-wing parties is a direct result of people being afraid of an African-American president. And then with the people that are around him, that are advising him, I think a lot of them are afraid of the backlash. And with the economy and all the other problems that he has, if he directly deals with race, then I think people are afraid that something may explode and that diversity, sharing the diversity where will happen.
Don, do you think there's still something to say, though? Is there a conversation? Does it remain to talk about race?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely a conversation, but he has, just like he has to be very smart about how he approaches that conversation and what he does and does not say. And I think what has happened is he's been paralyzed almost into seeming as if he's doing nothing, because he does have to walk a very fine line. And I'm sure it's one he's always walked, being a biracial person. He's always on that thin line, trying not to alienate either side. But as a president, he has to be a leader. So I agree with the speaker who said that really he's going to have to be pushed into some of these, and changing some things, for instance, from the black community, because if it comes from them, then mm-hmm. it'll take the pressure off of him looking like he did it directly.
Okay.
And instead, he will be responding to what the people want. And so maybe that would be an easier way for him to get some things that he wants done.
Okay.
And not alienate the larger culture. Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
And let me add this. I think there should be a distinction, and I want to make a distinction for sort of from my own perspective of sort of the question of avoidance, because avoidance is kind of separate from incorporating race at those moments when you can sort of forcefully sort of push for the issue. I think, for example, if you take his speech that he gave at the Democratic Convention, where he referred to the preacher from Georgia, now that's just outright avoidance, right? Everybody knows who Martin Luther King is. That's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That to me is what I would view as just kind of extreme sort of attempt to sort of bounce around this notion of race. And so even the very name of Martin Luther King must be hushed. That's not the same to me as talking about, say, health care, which is something that is of particular import to the black community, and then talking about it in a general sense. Yeah. Or to even talk about, although the black community is heavily affected by the economy and the loss of unemployment is like 15% in the black community, that in effect, if you are pushing for employment with specific acts, as the Congressional Black Caucus says, geared to place as opposed to, say, race, that gets the job done without having to deal with these sort of specters of backlash that really affect your ability to get the job done.
I want to come back to that. Yeah. We have to take a quick break, Paul, though, the race versus place and the class versus race and all of that. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from SAFI, Specialized Alternatives for Families and Youth, envisioning the day when every child is part of a loving family and is able to reach his or her greatest potential. Information is online at safy.org.
I listen to NPR every day. It gives us insight into why people do what they do and have a passion for it. We hear from people in their words, and it's not the reporters telling us what this and that person said, whether it's about the economy in the United States or the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Bethany Donnell, and WOSU is my source for in-depth reporting in a soundbite age.
Good morning. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich today. Currently, it's a high around 37 with some light rain. Those morning rain showers should taper off by this afternoon, high around 42. Tonight, cloudy skies with a chance of rain mixing with snow, especially after midnight, low around 28. And tomorrow, cloudy skies with a chance of afternoon snow showers with a high around 35. Coming up next hour on All Sides with Ann Fisher, hear two points of view about legislation to regulate the payday lending industry in Ohio. That's coming up in just about 20 minutes here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Andrew Grant Thomas, Deputy Director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at OSU, Paul Ortiz, University of Florida History Professor, and Nishani Frazier, History Professor at Miami University. Paul, you were gonna say something before the break. Apologize.
Well, some of the terms that we've been talking about, and this has really been a fascinating conversation. I really learned a lot from listening to what Dawn was saying when she called in, but the terms avoidance and backlash, we've talked about these quite a bit, and I mean in reality the backlash is already here, and I think we're probably wasting our time if we're just kind of worried and waiting for it to happen. I think we've already had Glenn Beck refer to national health care as reparations for African Americans, right? And we've had Lou Dobbs, you know, anti-immigrant on CNN discourse, but also questioning Barack Obama's U.S. citizenship. We've had Rush Limbaugh. In other words, that the backlash, we've been living with the backlash now for actually many decades. And so I think part of the frustration that I'm hearing among people is, you know, if Barack Obama is scared about talking about race because he's worried there's going to be a backlash, then he's not quite opening his eyes to the reality around him, which is that it's already here. People have already racialized all of the issues that we're talking about now. And in fact, when the housing crisis first broke out, and last year, even before the election of Obama, it was already racialized. We heard commentators on the major cable networks blaming African Americans and Latinos for dreaming of owning their own homes, and immediately that's the default of American politics. I mean that's one of the critical hinges is you blame people of color, you blame poor people, and one of the challenges I think that Barack Obama has is he has to change political discourse. I think Andrew referred earlier to, it isn't just about mobilization. It's about the discourse. It's about the ideology. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I think Barack Obama can do. But he has to recognize that his opponents are already very well ensconced in the media and politics and other places.
They've been doing this for a long time, in other words.
Exactly.
Yeah. Andrew, you had to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, on one hand, it's certainly true that, you know, a certain sort of focus on place or a certain sort of focus on class, that health care, jobs, you know, clearly African-Americans can be helped as others can be helped by these, you know, ostensibly non-racialized steps. But, you know, for a long time, I think we've made the mistake of thinking that those, especially class, can be substitutes for race. They really can't. We're going to miss a lot of what we'd hope to achieve if we think that sort of class-based measures, for example, can be substitutes for race. And let me just give one small example with respect to the stimulus package. You know, there were about $40 billion in federal contracts awarded last year to small businesses, and very, very few of them went to businesses owned by women, by Latinos, or African Americans. The AP did a report last year as well showing that there's much more government spending in places with the lowest unemployment rates than in places with the highest unemployment rates. The general point is this. The same vulnerabilities that meant that African Americans, Latinos, women, immigrants were in a worse position to begin with than others before the recession, B, were hardest hit by the recession, also accounts for the difficulty of getting them the help they need relative to getting others. In Massachusetts, when they did the universal health care, you know, that seems like, well, of course, universal health care, African-Americans more likely to be uninsured than others, surely that'll help them disproportionately. Well, there's some initial results showing that actually inequities in health care coverage has expanded since that happened because, again, the same vulnerabilities which affected their, you know, explained their circumstances to begin with also make them less likely to benefit from even quote-unquote universal policies. So, you know, it's, again, I very much appreciate Barack Obama's political challenge, but we cannot, you know, insist that the difficulty of speaking about race and of doing policies that are race conscious is the same as saying that it's impossible to do that. And there are lots of people doing good work on this, including my own institute.
Okay. A couple of things. First, Paul's sort of notion of backlash. I want to make a distinction. I don't consider sort of the Glenn Becks of the world backlash. All right. When Hassan refers to scaring the diversity out of white people, I think he's referring to a group of white people who are making movement towards sort of this notion of equality, diversity, and whose steps are slow but consistent, not the same thing as, you know, Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck. Those people are always going to be present, all right? And so I think what Barack Obama is having to deal with is not those people, but sort of the white folks who are beginning to sort of move toward a more openness toward diversity. Now, I think the problem has been is that he's allowed the Glenn Becks of the world to couch the discourse. Right, that's the problem, right? And not challenging that language and the rhetoric that they use with, and again, this is the part where we get into the avoidance by not calling it what it is, which is racism, that hinders, in effect, his ability to move forward, right? Because he gets drowned out by all this sort of screaming coming from Rush Limbaugh. Second thing, this whole notion of race, or by extension, race versus place, or really what it boils down is a notion of race versus class. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a notion of race versus class, and I don't intend to imply that. I think there is a question of race and class being very much intertwined, all right, and that both have a sort of debilitating effect on, the lower strata of the Black and Latino community. And so, yes, you take the issue of, say, health care and universal health care. I think that's a combination issue, right, of both class and race, not just the question of race or access for small businesses. You know, again, that certainly is the issue of race, but that doesn't affect the broader, you know, community of those people who are poor, struggling, trying to get a job, that type of thing. So I don't sort of mean to imply that there should be an absence of discussion, right? But there is a way in which you can utilize rhetoric to get to where you want to get to without sort of scaring the diversity out of white people. And that's what, you know, I think is sort of what he should be moving toward, and more aggressively so.
Let's take another call. Delbert, you wanted to talk about that Obama doesn't have the sort of support he needs.
Right. I'm saying that where's the Obama Tea Party at? Where is the people that believe in what he is trying to do and their loud voices? Because we're letting it seem like that the opposite, the opponents, are really the ones that's got the country in their favor. He needs the wind at his back. Instead of us setting back and letting him take the brutal beating that he's taking by these Tea Partiers, Where is his Tea Party group?
Where do you think they are, Delbert? Where do you think they are?
I don't. I'm not really sure. I've been trying to figure that out because I can't understand how people can be so against some of the things that he was trying to do that is so good for America, like health care and even like he made a move toward the black farmers just last
week. Right.
But he needs our support because it looks like that the opponents are the one who's got the favor right now and the wind at their back.
And I have to add something else. This is sort of my own sort of sticking point. When you think about the civil rights movement, I think part of the problem, and in terms of even sometimes the way in which Barack Obama is viewed, is the assumption that as a leader, that his voice is sort of the leading voice. Same thing in the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King. But the reality was is that there were many a person pulling Martin Luther King's coattail, all right, and saying, no, Martin, this is not acceptable. There are a number of diverse voices during the civil rights movement who are challenging Martin Luther King as sort of the singular leadership of the black community. And I think that the same thing has to be in place, that this is not a question of, you know, whether he is or is not talking about race. I think that he should. I don't think he should do any kind of avoidance. At the same time, I think it's our job.
But it cannot
our
be
job
up there by himself.
To pull his coattail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But Delby, you're saying that he just can't be on his own.
He doesn't be out there running on his own and expect to get anything done. We, the people, have to believe in him just like the Tea Party is believing what they're doing. And when it comes to race, yeah, they had a lot of racial signs, but they brought those down. But the people are still the same, and we're sitting back letting it happen to him. And when he's gone and the opportunity is blown, not only going to be it's going to be our fault too for not even trying to help him get to where he needs to go.
All right, Delbert, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Or push him.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that. I don't always agree with
him. Well, Delbert is bringing up a point that I think, you know, many people are asking right now, you know, where is the real Tea Party, not people who call themselves. But, you know, I think there's a reason when we think of the history of the civil rights movement, and I want to address history for a moment, which is that we have a crisis where we're not teaching the history of the civil rights movement. And I have to work with teachers constantly on this, and they're telling me that, well, I'd love to teach the history of the movement, but I don't have any course materials. I don't know anyone who's involved in it. I don't know where to look. And so our job as teachers is to get that information out there. But, you know, there's a reason that we refer to organizations in the movement. We refer to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We refer to CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, or SCLC. There's a reason that A. Philip Randolph, who was one of the key organizers of the March on Washington, was a trade union member, a trade union president. Mm-hmm. And that is the central importance of organizing and organizations in the movement was absolutely paramount. It wasn't just a movement of random individuals who come around and say, well, I really like this leader, I'm going to support him. As Nishani was saying, it was they had organizations. People built organizations that could pull Dr. King's coattails. You can't do that as an individual. You and I do not have that kind of power. But as organizations, and it doesn't have to be a separate civil rights organization. It could be a church. It could be a grassroots neighborhood-based group. But I think that, to me, is the missing equation right now in politics. Politics is not just simply the policies. It's the pressure at the grassroots. But the pressure at the grassroots has to come through organizations. And that's one of the things we're missing. That's why we don't have a kind of pro-Obama a Tea Party now, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Nishani?
I thoroughly agree with that, and to the degree that I think that should be a conversation about us, I think is sort of where it comes in, and community, and like I said, I think the problem of the sort of light of Barack Obama's first black president of the United States is that it does sort of act to hide some of the organization that is beginning to take place. I gave the example of black parents. I think one of the problems, however, is those organizations are not linking together. It's through these organizations that a movement is created and people are sort of drawn into that movement. So I think Paul is absolutely right. There's that missing element, but that doesn't mean we're not responsible for creating it.
Yeah, Andrew.
You know, the Paul's point about the importance of organizations, which is right on, brings to mind the recent Supreme Court case on campaign finance reform and campaign finance. And it will seem may seem tangential to a lot of folks, but it's really not. The Supreme Court essentially reaffirmed and strengthened the notion of corporations as people, mm-hmm. and as people with you know, sort of free speech rights and a right to voice their political opinions. Of course, the difference, as Paul sort of implied, or consistent with what Paul said, is that corporations and wealthy corporations can have much louder voices than you or I. And this is something that, you know, people need to read some of the comments on that decision, read the decision itself if you can. The notion that powerful corporations, you know, can now spend their own money to voice, quote-unquote, political opinions, and what that means for campaign finance has enormous civil rights implications, and certainly, you know, enormous implications for whose ideas and voices get heard in the, quote-unquote, marketplace of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to take one more call. We're getting toward the end here now. Michael, you're on the air. You want to defend Obama. Everyone wants to defend Barack Obama.
Thank you, Anne. What a great program, and I can't agree more with what was just said and Delbert's call. I just want to talk about how excited I was over a year ago when he was elected, but I remember saying to my wife, who the heck would want to be president at this time? And we forget.
I think I said the same thing.
And we forget. I hate to make a bad pun. There's a big elephant in the room. This was an inherited problem, 700,000 jobs lost, 600,000, 500, month by month. This was not his doing. I can't think of one thing that he's done wrong, to be honest with you, and it's all this negative talk. You know, healthcare was exactly what we needed to do because implicitly that's what took down GM. They had to build in 2,000 inflated healthcare costs in the making of their automobile. He attacked the financial system first, and he helped those of us that do have retirement programs go from 50% down to maybe recovering 20 or 30% of that. Then he did a stimulus program helping those policemen, teachers, people who need the jobs. Now, he could have done old technology and done roads like Governor Rhodes, but he chose to look at new technology, green technology, which takes more time. He could have attacked bridges. Maybe that's the only thing I would have said. Maybe those were shovel-ready, but I think those things actually take 5 or 6 years. So a Republican would have been given the credit. And I just think we forget what kind of mess. Americans want instant gratification, and they have no memories. You know, and the sad thing is, I think we're just a really uninformed, misinformed because of Fox. And it's really, it's almost like the regular news takes their cues from the loudmouths, and we're stuck without, like Delbert says, without any positive reinforcement. We were on the brink of a depression. The news almost should have been trying to pump things up.
Michael,
I
have to be a big mouth and shut you down.
Okay, no, I've said
because we're running out of time. We just have 30 seconds.
Sure, I would just love your comments.
Thanks. Well, in 30 seconds, I think that just tells me that we need to have you back on the show, and I hope you'll join us again. Mm-hmm. Andrew Grant Thomas, Deputy Director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, Paul Ortiz, History Professor at the University of Florida, and Nashani Frazier, History Professor at Miami University. Thanks to all of you. Appreciated it.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.